Welcome to the Caregiver's Toolbox, tools for everyday caregiving. We provide education and information on senior care topics. Here's your host, Ryan McInniff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Caregiver's Toolbox, tools for everyday caregiving. My name is Ryan McInniff. Appreciate you listening to our newest episode. And of course, today I have my guest is Denise Brown. Denise, what's going on?
What isn't going on? Wow.
So, so a quick thing on your bio. Let me read it for you. Denise began supporting individuals who care for a family member in 1990. She launched one of the first online communities for family caregivers in 1996, selling the site in March of 2020. Congratulations on that. She then founded the Caregiving Years Training Academy in March 2020, your new endeavor to inspire family caregivers and former family caregivers to become advocates, facilitators, specialists, consultants, and educators. For more information, visit careyearsacademy.com, careyearsacademy.com. Did I get that right for the most part with a little?
Yeah, that
little...
sounds awesome.
So your awesome. New endeavor is all about training and educating and getting people to plan basically for what could be happening or what is going on right now.
Yeah. And I think the training really came out of the initial need for family caregivers to feel like their experience isn't for naught, that they are gaining an expertise while they care for a family member that can actually inform what they do after caregiving ends. So there's training to be a support group leader. There's training to be an advocate, which actually you could take during your caregiving experience. And then there's training to start a small business to consult with current family caregivers. I remember years ago watching a webinar and a former family caregiver talked about caring for his mom. And he said, "Well, why does my knowledge base have to disappear once caregiving ends?" That really stuck with me. Why does it? And so our training programs, particularly for the consultant educator, really tap into that knowledge base. And then I complement what the family caregivers and former family caregivers bring into the training program with my perspectives about what happens during a caregiving experience and the communication strategies that really help minimize stress. When we're talking to family caregivers, we are talking to someone who is overwhelmed. And if we can't help manage their stress, we cannot help them. So I went through life coach training in 2004 and learned this communication strategy that I used every day with family caregivers. And that's what I teach in the training program as well.
You know, it reminds me, you know, I'm 36 years old, so I have a lot of family and friends, that have kids or are having kids or have just had kids. And there is a large community that is more than happy to help you raising your child, at least giving you information, right? You can go on Facebook and you can find the mothers groups and then you can ask questions. You can say, is it normal for me to want to just go ballistic right now? And people go, yes, it is. You know, there's that support where you need help. And I don't feel as much as there's that support when somebody's aging and you're trying to handle an aging parent who's, you know, unfortunately declining, because the stigma and the thing that nobody wants to talk about is that decline ends with somebody's death eventually, or whatever long enough time span we are, we're all going to die. And I think, does that feel like one of the things that you're seeing, and that's kind of one of the reasons why you're trying to do this, to get it a little bit less taboo to talk about these things and to have shared experiences, or am I off base here?
I think that it's changing. So when I launched my online community back in 1996, there were just a few of us, literally a few of us. And then Facebook came along. And I would say that Facebook changed where and how individuals caring for a family member receive support. They are on Facebook. They are talking in groups and private groups. They are sharing their experiences. They are really getting a lot of support. I will also say that Twitter really opened my eyes. I joined Twitter in 2009, and I remember someone tweeting about a very personal, difficult caregiving challenge. And I thought, okay, now we're going mainstream. So social media has made a big difference in how family caregivers receive support. It still is not a situation where everybody will run in and help you for decades, because a caregiving experience lasts for decades. It's because it's a really painful experience. There's loss on a regular basis. There are difficulties in trying to find the right resource at the right time. And a lot of people have a hard time staying with that. And our consultants who have gone through a caregiving experience know what that pain is like and are able to stay with someone throughout their painful experience. That's very unusual, but you know what? We want good company. When our heart is breaking, we just want someone to sit next to us and just listen to what it's like, what that heartbreak feels like, and what causes that heartbreak.
Yeah, and I think I noticed that in a smaller fashion with some of my friends whose family members have passed away from cancer. And that's how I got into this, where my mom had cancer and she passed away. And it's a very, when you're part of that group, and unfortunately a lot of people are part of that group, but as you get older and you become the first one or the second one that happens to in your friend group, you notice that people come to you kind of quietly when their parent or loved one gets cancer and says, like, what am I getting into right now? And so, you know, while caregiving, I mean, people get caregivers for cancer, but a lot of the times when you're talking about caregiving, you're talking about things that go on for months and months, if not years. You know, the situation with my mom was 3 months, so it was a very limited amount of time. But I can certainly relate to that feeling when, you know, people start kind of saying, hey, what's going on? What happens? What should I expect? And can you give me some insight here?
I will also say that really the big stigma that we're working against right now is that family caregivers are of a certain age and a certain gender. And you just now described yourself as a family caregiver, and you are not what we would consider to be the age and the gender of a typical family caregiver. And what happens when we don't really just think of everyone as a family caregiver, we overlook the family caregivers who could really be needing support and help. And we're also missing out on the opportunities to connect that family caregiver to another in a similar situation. Caregiving happens at any stage in life. It's just the reality of it. I wish it didn't. I wish it never happened. We talk about it as the club that no one wants to join. But if we can share the stories of people having a caregiving experience when they're younger, it helps talk about that experience with younger individuals so that they can seek support and help.
Yeah, I mean, that, I think you shared it on Twitter as well, but we both saw the AARP statistics come out and the report come out. And one of the things, and of course, since I'm at the very beginning of this generation with millennials, though everybody assumes I'm older, you know, you're surprised to see that 25% of millennials are caregivers already. And, you know, people, I think in their minds still have that mindset that, you know, millennials are still super young and they're, you know, just in college, and maybe some of them are still young, not me. But you know, they're growing up rather quickly, and they're taking on responsibilities. And I assume there are plenty of them that were in my position where my parents had me later in life at 35. People have children now at 40 years old. And so that caregiving, the caregiving duties come a lot sooner than people expect now, because, you know, nothing's cookie cutter anymore in the world in life, where you have kids by 22 and then da, 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 and you do your thing. Like maybe it was previous generations. So it's changing, and it was surprising for me to see that amount of people that have caregiving duties now.
I also think we have to look at the younger adults who might not be providing direct care. We might not say that they are the primary family caregivers, but they are impacted by a caregiving experience in their family. So it could be that their mom is caring for their dad, or their mom is caring for grandparents or in-laws. There's an impact, and there's an impact on their childhood, so to speak. And it's important that we figure out how to support them as well. because there's a lot of suffering that happens within the family. And if we can't talk about it, we can't get in there and help with that suffering. It's really important. One of my consultants is actually recovering after the loss of his wife. His wife died just about a year and a half ago. And we were talking about his focus, and he wants to help young adults. We decided that there was an opportunity for him to help young adults who are grieving, who are attending a university. Now, this, of course, is pre-COVID-19. But what he did over the winter was reach out to universities in his area and say, I'd love to start a support group for your students who might be grieving the loss of a family member. And the universities were like, yes, we need that. We need that on campus. And I think it's important to think about, where do we offer the support? It's typically thought of as like a senior center, but family caregivers aren't always seniors. And so we have to go where the family caregivers are, even the grieving ones. And that could be at universities, at the college level, in high schools.
Absolutely. And on, you know, when I do the podcast, I talk about the business side, I talk about the caregiving side. And that's one interesting thing that I never thought about when I got into this business, is that it's this kind of weird thing where we're providing care to one party, but we need to convince a second party to trust us with their loved one. And then we need to convince a third party, meaning the referral source, like an assisted living, a nursing home, or a hospital, to make that referral to us. So there's really, in the sales process, there's three different people that you need to convince to use your services. And that's to your point of, you know, how do you reach out to this the typical family caregiver? You know, and granted, you were saying that the caregivers can be across the spectrum, but a lot of caregivers that I find are in that mid 40s to 65 year old range, that 20 year gap or age range. How do you reach out to those people? How do you find those people in a world that's so hectic? It's so tough to nail somebody down for 5 minutes, let alone 15, 20 minutes with a conversation. How have you found that with being able to help people out and find those individuals out there?
So when I started by really sharing content that spoke to the experience. And then I invited others to share their experience, other family caregivers. And that's what drew the audience. Something that I see happening every day is that family caregivers are within a system. It's the workplace system. It's the healthcare system. It's a house of worship system. So they are talking to people every day. They are even showing up every day with their caree, and yet the referrals to support don't happen. I was talking to one of my consultants the other day, and she said, you know, I look back on caregiving when I was taking care of my dad, and it never occurred to me to reach out for help for myself. And I said, of course not. You were too stressed out. It's not up to you. But think about how many healthcare professionals, how many community resources, how many health support services within a house of worship did you interact with who knew you were caring for your father and did not make a simple referral? And that simple referral could be to a website, to a Facebook group, to a local social service agency. It just has to start with one referral to open up the perspective of a family caregiver, which is, oh, it's not just me. Oh, others get this. And I also, something that you talked about earlier, which is that parents will really connect with other parents and be really honest about what they're feeling. A caregiving experience is really challenging for us emotionally. And because we start to judge how we're feeling, we often just exist in silence about it because we think people are going to think I'm the worst person in the world if I really share what this is like. So we ourselves are thinking, I can't tell anybody about this. But if you read, for instance, a blog where someone says, this is how I feel, you think, wow, it isn't just me. That's why I've always thought it was so important that it's the voice of family caregivers that we really spread far and wide. Because when people have the permission to share honestly, we're going to create that community where that honest conversation makes a difference. So for instance, I did a national caregiving conference for 4 years, and the presenters were family caregivers and former family caregivers because they're the experts. We want to hear what it's like for someone else who's trying to figure this out. It was so compelling. The content that we shared at the conferences was heartbreaking, and at the same time, it was so full of humor because we were able to show up and just share what it's like and really enjoy and receive because of that amazing sharing.
Yeah, and I remember you promoting those, and I remember them being it seemed like they were very successful. And you know, one of those things that I guess I was thinking about is maybe, you know, changing the narrative on the experience within in your head with the experience with caregiving. Like, hey, listen, you're there for your parent, and that's a good thing. And you know, this is, you know, in the sense of, we say, hey, well, the joys of raising a child, right? That kind of way of saying you're going to be dealing with diapers and crying and up at night and da-da. Well, you know, the changes say, hey, listen, maybe it's not the joys of somebody aging and declining, but it's more of like, hey, you're being there for your loved one in their time of need. And I bring that up is because I remember when my mom had passed away, she had written notes to I had a small family. It was my dad and I, and then maybe two. One other person or two other people within my family that she felt compelled to write a goodbye note to. And my dad shared the note that she wrote him. And it said, you know, how about Ryan? You know, our only son was living in, we moved down to Florida from Massachusetts. He moved out to Colorado. And within 6 weeks of my diagnosis, he had quit his job, rented out his condo that he had just bought the year before, and packed up his stuff and moved on down to Florida. Like, what kind of, you know, what kind of son, but what a great son we had that would be willing to do that. And that doesn't mean that a son that, excuse me, or a child that doesn't do that is a bad, you know, there are circumstances that you can't get out of. I happen to be fortunate that I was younger. I didn't have a family. I didn't have a situation that I couldn't get up and leave. But it, you know, it meant a lot to me to have her recognize that, like, that was a huge sacrifice on my end as well, that I didn't take more than a millisecond to think about. But not everybody has that opportunity to do that. And so, you know, that's kind of like the joy of being able to have been there for my mom rather than flying in once every 2 weeks or once a week, because that's all you're able to manage. And that's all that can be done at that point in time. And it's, you know, and like you said, with the content, with your conferences, everybody's experience is totally unique. Everybody's the snowflake, where there, just because two people have a experience with a parent with cancer, combining words apparently, that doesn't mean it's going to be the same experience. And so you could have a whole day of people talking about their cancer caregiving experience, and everybody's is going to be completely different, and it's going to still be insightful for the people that are in the audience listening.
Absolutely. I think about chat rooms that I used to offer through my online community. And there was a visitor that came in one time who was caring for her dad, who had a very similar situation to my experience with my dad. My dad was diagnosed with cancer in 2004. His cancer advanced. They removed his bladder, so he now has a bag. We call it a bag, informal term for it. And someone else was caring for her dad who had a bag. And it was an amazing conversation, and I can't tell you how refreshing it was to talk about the leaks and the challenges with trying to find the right type of bag. We were very specific in our conversation, that, and it's not a conversation I could have had with anybody else, including my siblings. But that connection makes such a difference. It's just a relief. It literally felt like for those few moments, I didn't have so much pressure on my shoulders, and I could just engage in a conversation with someone who really got it.
Who understood what was going on.
Yes. I think the other challenge during a caregiving experience is that with parenting, you know when the milestones are going to happen, which means you know that your child is going to move out of diapers, for instance, or move into the school system, or start to be more independent. it's the exact opposite in a caregiving experience. You're not sure how long each stage of a disease process is going to last. It makes it very difficult to plan because you're just not sure how long to plan for. And that uncertainty is difficult to live with because we feel like sometimes, well, I can't make plans because I'm just not sure. And part of our happiness is having plans in place for activities that we can enjoy or times with relationships that we can enjoy. And without that, it can feel particularly isolating for us.
You know, absolutely. It's something in which, you know, and not having that plan, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because you're talking about connecting with people, but not having that plan and not knowing when those milestones, they're milestones, right? They're not great milestones, but they're still nonetheless a milestone in somebody's life. We think about nowadays with family, you know, I remember I was snowboarding somewhere and they have on a whiteboard at the very base of the mountain while you're waiting to get on the lift, trivia fact. And it was like, you know, what is something that everybody, I forget it, it's terrible. But anyways, I'm not saying the riddle correctly, but the point of the riddle was that the vast majority of Americans live within 30 miles of where they were born. Meaning that families usually stick together. So the riddle was like, you know, it was some question about that. And if you got it, you know, maybe you got a snow cone or something. But the point was, you know, that used to be the norm, right? That everybody kind of lived in the same general geographical area. Even if you moved, like I'm in Massachusetts. So if you moved out to West Massachusetts, that was a big move. Oh my God, you're an hour and a half away. And then I'm a perfect example of where a parent moved down to Florida. I moved over to Colorado, and I was two time zones away from my parents. What are you seeing now that the family construct has kind of moved out drastically, where people are on California when the parents live in Massachusetts? That's got to be a big thing that you talk about, or your training academy must work with that long distance caregiving. Because, you know, with my dad, I'm very lucky he has a girlfriend now, in the sense that if something were to happen to him, at least there's immediate help there until I can get down, versus if he didn't have that help and support, he'd be sitting in a hospital or a nursing home until I'm able to get down there within a day or two of catching a flight. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit and what you're seeing with your experience in the caregiving world?
I think we all have worries, and that's where we start with our plans. So our consultants actually can create plans with clients, which we call a family emergency plan. And we have these tools, which are wheels, that are cut up into pie slices. And for each pie slice, there's a word. So you look at a wheel and you see 8 words. And it's just to spark a conversation with a client. So we start with what a client is worrying about. And then we think about, well, what if? I really believe every worry needs a plan. People tell us on a regular basis, you know, statistically, 90% of what you worry about won't happen, except for a family caregiver. We've experienced that 10% over and over and over. And if we don't listen to our worries, we cannot sleep at night. So we put the plans in place and really talk out, what if this happens? What if that happens? And I found that what's really critical to a plan, which often we overlook, is communicating. So if we want to know something about what to do, it's a conversation with our caree, or it's a conversation with our siblings or other family members, or it's a conversation with a resource like a home care agency. How can you help if this happens? It's really gathering that information after asking those questions and then talking it out. Hey, what do you think about this plan if this happens? You know, it's all about peace of mind during caregiving. And if we have plans for our worries, then we have an opportunity to enjoy some peace of mind. And I think even just writing it out and talking it out with someone who gets it, like our consultants, can make a huge difference. Of course, the challenge is during caregiving that there's never a perfect solution. So we're always looking for something that's closer to a compromise rather than a sacrifice. And sometimes that can feel difficult to find. But if there's something that we can piece together that helps us know if this happens, this is what I'm going to do, it can make the day a little bit easier for us.
You know, that's a great thing that you've said, and I've always felt relating that to private home care world. I want, of course, everything to go perfectly, and my hair is gone because of that, because it doesn't. But one of the things that I've always felt like in private home care, but in medical care in general, is that people's expectations are through the roof. And then sometimes, those expectations need to be tampered quite a bit, unfortunately. And I've seen family caregivers come to our services and expect that since they're paying privately for us, everything's going to be running perfectly. And I'm sitting there going like, no, like this, there's still going to be, imagine we're on a plane flying through a hurricane. We are talking about there will 100% be turbulence. We're talking about how much turbulence there's going to be. And by the end of the 2 years or the 3 years they were using our services, I feel like there was that conversation that said, you know what, any of the issues I had were more of a industry-wide issue, the complications that come from just being involved in senior care or private home care. But overall, I thought you did a great job. But I realized now, looking back, that my expectations were absolutely pie in the sky when it needed to be much more tampered. And I imagine that a lot of people go through that. You know, it would be like buying a car, right? Like, you know, the first time you buy a major purchase, like a house or a car, and you go through something and you go, oh, my expectations were a lot different than what actually happened in real life. And it's the same thing. But of course, when it's your family member and it's super personal and you want your loved one who cared for you, assuming you have a good relationship with them, which is a whole nother topic, you know, that's obviously not the same thing as buying just a house or a car that is a it's not a person. So that's something that rings true to me without a doubt. And I'm sure it rings true to a lot of people out there.
Yeah. The expectations become the assumptions, and they are silent assumptions. We don't ever say, now I'm assuming that who I am scheduled with as a home health aide is going to be that same person that shows up on time going forward forever. Right. That's the assumption. And the reality is that just literally is not possible. The other expectation that we turn into assumptions is around our family. Who will help us? We think siblings absolutely will step in and help us. And on a regular basis, we see that that oftentimes does not happen. It's just trying to stay with the vulnerability, which I talked about earlier, is very difficult for some siblings. So I think it's so important to remember that oftentimes our easiest solution is to ask and talk out so that we can reduce the expectations and then, try to avoid the assumptions, because we don't want to be caught off guard. We are much better if we have all the information, even the information that we think, oh, darn it, I didn't want to know that. I did not want to know that. But that helps form our decisions and our actions. We have to be realistic during a caregiving experience. It is so hard to be realistic because we're looking for the break. And sometimes the break feels like denial. I'll just be in denial about this and it'll give me a little breathing room. Certainly we can visit denial once in a while to get that breath where we can just feel like, okay, I'm going to relax a little bit and pretend none of this is going on. But we have to live in the real world. And it's a tough world out there right now, especially if you're in a caregiving experience.
Absolutely. And you know what, when I started, I bought Minute Women from an aunt. And so when I started doing this and going forward with it, I was very scared to go to a Denise Brown and say, hey, listen, here are the pros and cons. Like, there are some cons to this, because I was scared to lose the sale and I needed the revenue. And then I realized, after you get some confidence under you, that, you know what, you don't want the person that thinks that it's going to be perfect, because it's not going to be. And I'd rather be upfront and honest. And if Denise says, listen, this isn't what I, you know, company B told me that nothing would go wrong ever, and that this thing, da, 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 da. And then, my phone went off. I apologize. And then all of a sudden, you know, the that customer is coming back saying, you promised me that this would never happen. And then, it was guaranteed to happen, or the probability was there. And I realized it's so much better to be upfront and honest. Not that I wasn't being honest, but you get my point. And then that kind of feeling of the confidence of saying, hey, this is what it is, really parlayed into the podcast, where it said, well, if I'm being honest with Denise one-to-one, why wouldn't I be honest with everybody out there on what the, and we've done podcasts on the pros and cons of SNFs, assisted livings, private home care. You know, nobody's going to love your mom as much as you love your mom. So, you know, you have to understand what the pros and cons to all of these things are. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, some of these things where, yeah, absolutely. There's the expectations and then there's reality as well. You know,
I just want to put in a plug, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
For our new training for family caregivers that actually is offered by are certified caregiving consultants. They are instructors in a certified training program for family caregivers. And what made me think of it is we've been talking about assumptions, and oftentimes there's an assumption that we are caring for someone we love. And that's sometimes not the case. It's the reason why we use the term caree rather than caring for a loved one. We use the term caree. And one of our instructors, Danelle LeBlanc, has really been open about her experience around the assumptions people made about her during her caregiving experience. She cared for her father-in-law, who was white, and she is a young Black woman. And so people always made the assumption that she was his home health aide. And she spent a lot of time trying to tell people, I am his daughter-in-law. I am his primary family caregiver. I am someone he loves, and I love him. So she's actually put together a class where we can find the words to overcome assumptions that people might make about us. So within the healthcare system, people might make assumptions about our relationships with our caree, or about our ability to provide care, or about our ability to receive complicated information. So I hope people will think about our training academy in terms of training not only for after caregiving ends, but during their caregiving experience, because we've got these great courses that really speak to what it's like and what information and skills you'll need in order to feel like, okay, I can do this, to really quell the doubts and increase the confidence.
You know, that's, excuse me, that's a perfect segue, because one of the things I have your website up here, and I was like, this is a question I wanted to ask. I thought it might be worthwhile, since this is part of what your business is, or it seems like a big part of your business, is you have becoming a certified advocate, consultant, facilitator, and specialist. And then, of course, there's the family care manager. Maybe it would be worthwhile doing a 2-minute thing on each one, on what are the differences of it and who might be the right person to fill that need for that certification.
Okay, so an advocate is our lowest priced training. It's 1 hour, and it helps you formulate your movement to make a difference. I walk you through a plan that you create, that you take out into the world to change an aspect of a caregiving experience. Our facilitator training is if you want to lead support groups. We equip you with the skills you need. You use that then to create the support group that you want. So our training is helpful if you're going to start a dementia care support group or a cancer care support group. And then we have the specialist training. When I think about my work as a small business owner, I know I work best when I have a coach and when I have a virtual assistant. So that's what I wanted to create for a family caregiver. So our specialist is that virtual assistant that takes on tasks, that helps that family caregiver get organized, that takes a little bit of the load off the to-do list. And then our consultant is really that coach who helps with strategies and decisions and stress management. And then our consultants can go to the next level and become educators, and they receive a proprietary presentation, which is the staging of the experience that I developed in 1997. And they can take that presentation out into their community or online to really inform family caregivers about the experience and what they can expect as they move through their stages.
I mean, that's succinct, and that's about as good as it's going to get. Good job. A+. The elevator speech, outstanding. One question I do have, because there's obviously an elephant in the living room here with COVID-19 and nursing homes. Have you seen or are you feeling like now that you have COVID out there and I'm just, you know, just like opinions are like belly buttons. Everybody's got one. My opinion is that we're probably going to be living with COVID for a long time in the sense of just like the flu, right? You're going to have this yearly shot or whatever it might be. But right now there are a lot of people that are trying to figure out what to do with their loved one. Do I keep them in a nursing home or an assisted living? Do I bring them home with private home care? Do I get rid of private home care? Because, you know, obviously the more people that the caree is the word you use, the caree is around, the higher chance you're going to get infected. And we now know that for basically anybody under 70 or maybe 65, your risk, unless you have a pre-existing condition, is relatively low with this. But if you are older and you have comorbidities, i.e. you're in a nursing home, this is really, really bad news for you because of your training academy, your experience, and how you can, I'm sure, help and consult people. What are you seeing right now with this kind of new challenge that's been sprung on us with the economy going on and now people are not working as much, or maybe they've been furloughed, but they're like, I'm going to be going to work in another 2 months. Make sense of the tornado.
Oh, I wish I could. I wish I could calm the tornado. But I think that this is really going to be what changes the care that's provided in facilities. So we knew that infection control was a problem before COVID-19, and this has just exposed the problem. I think there are so many dominoes that fall because of this. So for instance, will skilled nursing facilities be able to attract the staffing that they need? So we knew that staffing was a problem already. How does And you live it. So yeah. How does a skilled nursing facility attract staff anyway? So I definitely think we're going to see closings of facilities. And I think it's going to really impact the options that families have about where care takes place. I also think that you could look at what's the impact on the budget for instance, a skilled nursing facility. Have budgets taken a hit? So even if you felt like it's an option, maybe the budget isn't there. I do think that families have to be aware of the potential risks for home care, but I do think it's important that they keep as much as they can, because that's what keeps their carry out of the hospital. I think families are struggling with situations and decisions that are difficult, and I think it's so important that no one make those decisions alone. It's important to talk it out and really weigh the risks and know that a decision you make today could be a decision that you change next week, and that's okay. You know, we have so many changing dynamics going on in our world. I think there's uncertainty about staffing. I think there's uncertainty about money. And I think there's uncertainty about the level of care that people can provide at home, which is really why we've got our training for family caregivers, because we know more and more individuals are going to be providing more and more care. And we want them to know that there's support for them, that they don't have to figure everything out on their own, that there are others who have figured it out and want to teach them what they've learned. So I guess when I think about the future, I think there's going to be less facilities. I think policies in facilities will change around infection control. But I also think the other big change will be who visits when there is an outbreak. So I've connected with family caregivers from Canada on Twitter who've been very vocal about their concerns because they have not been able to visit their carees in a facility. And they know that it has directly impacted in a negative way their carees' care and really the status quo. So I think we're going to have to look at how do we ensure that a family caregiver is looked at as a member of the care team that must visit, regardless of where it is, hospital or facility. And if you think about it from that perspective, we have to ensure that family caregivers are equipped, that they have what they need, the right kind of mask, the right kind of protective equipment so that where they need to go, they are equipped to go. So if they have to go to the hospital because their carry is hospitalized, they can put on their personal protective equipment and go, because the hospital's not going to provide that for them. But if they want to be in the hospital, they need to have that. So I think of this as really the opportunity for us to look at the role of family caregiver is not this informal, unpaid role, but it's a profession that people take on. And because it's a profession, we have to treat these family caregivers like professionals who are an important and critical part of the care team.
And right now, and though it's a little off subject, but you kind of just mentioned it, right now you can't get paid as a family caregiver. Correct? Meaning that if you're caring for your parent, you can't accept a salary for that. Or am I mistaken?
So there's a couple options, but not many. So for instance, if your carry qualifies for Medicaid, and if your state has a Medicaid waiver program, you could be reimbursed for providing care. There is no training or support for you though. You just receive the pay. But I think if you are going to be paid, you also need to be well-trained and supported. If your carry has a long-term care insurance policy, some policies will allow that family member to receive pay for providing care. And I also have seen families pool their money to pay that primary family caregiver. One of the reasons that we have this training program to certify family caregivers is to turn it into a profession so there are more opportunities for them to get paid. So for instance, what if a Medicare Advantage plan reimbursed that family caregiver for providing care? What if there was a benefit that allowed a home care agency to provide some care and the family who's providing the rest of the care to be reimbursed? The reality is this is an economic issue. If we have individuals who are leaving the workforce because they have to care for a family member because there isn't a facility in their community any longer, we are setting up a large group of people to head into retirement without any money, and we do not have a system in place to take care of them. If we take care of the family caregivers, if we allow reimbursement, if we provide insurance for them, if we have a retirement plan for them, our economy benefits. It's a group of people that need and deserve this kind of care that aren't getting it, but it's the economy that will be sacrificed as well. And if we look at caregiving as an economic issue, it makes complete sense to take care of the family caregivers. Years ago, I wrote a blog post about where's our WPA for caregiving. So thinking about during the Depression, you know, the Public Works Act really saved people because it provided jobs. Well, we know there are people already working and doing an amazing service and are saving the healthcare system billions of dollars. Let's look at them as a workforce that needs to be reimbursed.
Yeah, I mean, I see it all the time with private home care is that, you know, one of the Achilles heels of private home care is that nobody wants low hours. Or if you do accept a low hour case, then I have to overcharge so much for it because I've got to pay a caregiver to go out there and nobody's willing to go out there for 2 or 3 hours at a time. And so we've worked with families that it's like, hey, listen, what about you handle the morning and the nighttime and then we can do in the middle blocks of time when you're at work, or some type of compromise like you're talking about where we're certainly supplementing that help as much as we can. But at the end of the day, you know, it goes back to kind of the expectations and the realistic kind of ability to provide care. We need to be able to at the very least be able to fill in those gap times where people need help, and how do you go about doing that? And it sounds like what you're suggesting at least is some type of solution to maybe being able to bridge that gap, because it's a concern that I have as well, where what happens if you have, I mean, and I'm in private home care, what happens if one of my employees all of a sudden needs to say, hey, I got to work 30 hours a week because I need to be at home for X, Y, and Z. What do I do in this scenario? And it's like, oh, well, you know, if it could affect me, it could affect anybody. And you certainly don't want that economic issue to occur. That's a brain drain on the economy as well. And it, you know, right now we don't have as many people as we'd like coming up and being able to fill that. And additionally, like you said, is that, you know, people still are worried about retirement and saving. We don't have enough of that in that country. So if you take people out of the workforce during their prime earning years, then you're setting up for a vicious cycle that the next generation is going to be doing the same thing for their parents that their parents are doing for their grandparents right now. And how do you break that cycle, and how do you allow that not to happen anymore? And that's a big question. And at the end of the day, like you said, it's an economic question. You know, are we okay as a country? You know, right now as a country, in my little diatribe, we don't really seem to care about old people. You know, they go to a nursing home, they get kind of forgotten about, and hey, listen, once you're no longer a quote unquote value to society, we kind of brush you away, and that's the end of that. Are we okay with getting taxed at another 5% or 8% or whatever that number is to be able to provide the right amount of care for people, or have some type of solution? And I'm certainly well below the brain to be able to come up with that solution. I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I know that there needs to be some type of solution to this, because it's a massive pain point and it's causing a lot of stress on a lot of adults in the United States, as well as their carees and their loved ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the time is now, because so many things have really been uncovered because of COVID-19. Just the role of family caregivers and how they directly impact a caree's care is now shown. We know that if you do not have family members visiting your residence, the residence care, their level of care and quality of life declines. That is how important families are in terms of the care that's provided. And I also think, because we have seen the strain of the healthcare system, and more people are exposed to that strain, have experienced it, we're gonna see that there's a movement to change it, that it becomes, that we become a country that cares for everybody. I really believe that that's where we're heading. I think we have to, I don't know how to say this in a way that sounds politically correct. I think we have to blow up some institutions, blow up some systems, blow up some ways of thinking, blow up the old way in order to make new way for the new way. But I really believe that's what's going to happen.
No, I agree with you on that. It you know, the problems, and the problems that we're facing as a country as a whole, whether it's senior care, whether it's race relations and justice, whether it's equality, whether it feels like there's no just like tweak and then everything gets fixed, right? Like, we just tweak this knob over here, we tweak this knob, and that will go. It feels like, you know, whether it's the education system, whether it's the taxation system, it feels like it's a situation, and it's not meant to be like scary that we have to like nuke everything, but it has to be a careful look at how we're doing things. And, you know, I look at it as building a house. At some point in time, the foundation of the house it's no longer worth continuing to patch it and add things on versus taking it all apart and just building a new one. And at some point in time, there's no return on investment. How many times are we going to keep patching the same wheel over and over and over again? And now all of a sudden, when you ride the bike down the road, you're wobbling all over because there's a patch here and patches here, versus saying, hey, we just need to replace the tires. And that's a scary thing to do, because the unknown is scary, right? And the known, as bad as it might be, it's stable and you know what to expect, versus just like you were talking about with children versus seniors. When you're raising a child, you know the milestones, you know what to expect, versus when somebody's declining, you don't know when those milestones are occurring. And I think that fear of the unknown is part of the reason why we've been okay with the status quo versus willing to risk change. And maybe the change doesn't work out. Maybe you have to, like in Massachusetts, we had something where it was a taxation and it was sundowning after 2 years. And at least that sundowning that was there for why they chose that terminology is interesting since we're talking about senior care. But they chose that sundown, who basically said after 2 years, this thing is going to go away, because if it stinks and everybody hates it, then it goes away. And if it works and it's good, we'll continue it. And maybe you could do something like that to alleviate people's fears that say, hey, we're going to try something for 4 or 5 years, and then it's going to sundown. And unless Congress votes for it to continue moving forward, then it would go away. But at least there's something to at least make an effort to try, rather than keep doing the same thing over and over again that gets results that for the most part people aren't really happy about.
And I think we see that actually with the protesters. I have been so inspired by them and their energy and their cohesiveness and their diversity. I think they are showing us the way that things can be different and that we actually have the solutions. All we have to do is implement them.
Yeah, it's very, it's very eye-opening to see how quickly things can change when all of a sudden the streets are filled. And it's unfortunate that that's what it takes, because I think, you know, it's a bipartisan issue of how slow things change with government, and how what some people feel as would make sense and shouldn't be such a struggle becomes such a struggle, whether it's about what the protests are about right now or anything. It just seems like it is extraordinarily, you know, slow to get anything to change or anything done. And it's unfortunate that you need to have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people braving COVID, going out. And listen, well, let's be honest, there COVID is going to spike because of this, because you just have tens of thousands of people marching and walking and exercising, basically walking 6 or 7 miles at a time. And because this is such a problem and people feel about it, you know, does that need to be done for every single problem that we have in this country to get some type of solution, bringing this back to senior care? Like, do you have to march in the streets to get something changed within the nursing home facilities? Because the concern I have is, you're inspired. My concern, and I don't mean to be pessimistic, is it's just going to get brushed under the rug. And then once this thing kind of, that's the way things go. And then all of a sudden, you're kind of back to the status quo. And I certainly don't want to see that happen either. And I guess time will tell, but you know, that's my concern with this, is that nothing ends up happening and we just go back to the same old, same old.
Except family caregivers are part of the protest because they're out there protesting. They're just young. So at our conference this past November, we had 4 students from Brigham Young. We had another student from the Chicagoland area, all talking about their innovations and their technology that they want to introduce because of what they saw their parents go through during a caregiving experience. So those protesters are out there fighting for justice, but they don't have a limited view of what justice is. They are fighting for justice for everyone. And I find that really inspiring. And I am amazed at their energy, and I wish I had some of it. But I believe that there is a solution that they will come up with that helps everybody. I think there's a process that they put in place that ensures that everybody receives the care, the respect, and the opportunities that they deserve. We're really talking about making sure that everybody has an opportunity for a better life, no matter your age or your gender or your color. That's what we're working toward, is opportunity for everybody.
And so, since we're on extraordinarily controversial, apparently, topics, I'm going to ask you another controversial. And if you don't want to talk about it, we'll just edit this out. But one thing, I was having a conversation with a nurse friend of mine, and we were talking about COVID and the issues with and she's a nurse at a hospital. She goes, you know, almost all the people that we're seeing with COVID have these comorbidities, and most of the time, they're very, very old. Yeah, and so when we think about nursing homes, we think about we place ourselves there, but in a lot of nursing homes, especially the long-term care side, a lot of it's dementia. And the reason why this is so rampant in the nursing homes as well as assisted livings is obviously people with dementia don't really have great short-term memory, and so they don't know why they need to be in the room. They should be washing their hands, don't touch your face, all of those things, socially distance. And it brought up a conversation that we've had, that I've had with my family members, on what you want to happen when you die. And I've been a very big proponent that I think nationwide we should have assisted suicide, in the sense that if you have a terminal disease, you should be able to say in your will, my name's Ryan. The second I don't know my loved one's names and don't recognize them, you know, give me the happy pills that take me to the happy place, and we're done with this, because I don't want to be a burden with my family. And this might be a bit controversial, but this nurse was like, how many of these individuals that are in these nursing homes would want to be there in the first place? Because they don't have the option not to be there, because we don't have we treat our animals a lot more humanely at end of life than we treat our own loved ones. And I wanted to, since we're talking about this, do you have any thoughts on what might happen in the future with end of life care and being able to determine when you want to ultimately expire? When you, it's your body, it's your life, shouldn't you have a say in how you want to pass away and leave this world?
So it goes back to communication. So you are in a process of communicating your wishes. It's also important to have a conversation about those wishes, so that people don't just say, well, he wrote this, but does he mean it? We have to have these ongoing conversations about our personal wishes. And I completely agree with you. I will also say that I think the healthcare system has lured us into believing that we can live forever, because they always have another treatment or cure that we should consider. And I think that we have lost the perspective of what a natural cycle of life is. And I think we have to bring that conversation back into our dialogue with doctors, so that a doctor who says, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this one more thing, let's try this one more thing, is not a doctor we use. That we actually choose our healthcare professionals who engage us in honest, and it goes back to the real conversations, the real situations, keeping us realistic about what is quality of life going forward for our carees. And I think about, so it's hard not to have a personal opinion about this, and I don't want it to mean to sound like I'm having an opinion for everyone, but I am sometimes concerned about individuals who are at a certain age with certain situations going into a hospital anyway, because that's going to significantly decrease their quality of life. And I think we have to have the courage to say, a hospital is not where I need my caree to be. A hospital is not going to save my caree and give them back the quality of life that they deserve. Instead, I'm going to look at where they are right now and how do I keep them here so they can receive comfort and have the best day possible. Because if I send them to the hospital, chances are they're not going to have the best day possible. That takes courage. It takes courage to be able to do that. But I think we're moving into a situation where we're having honest conversations about what are our perspectives of death and how do we define quality of life? And when we reach life that doesn't provide quality, what are our options? And what are the options that do not involve another treatment or another promise of a cure that actually is not going to cure us?
Yeah, and at the, you know, we were talking about economics, and at the end of the day, it goes back to economics. You know, we talk poorly about the military-industrial complex because, you know, it's all designed to kill people, right? Defend the country means that you're going to have to drop a bomb or shoot a gun. But there's also the health system complex, where a lot of people, including the hospitals, make a lot of money by providing care for people. I remember we were caring for a gentleman that was getting dialysis 3 times a week. So we would have to go with him for 4 or 5 hours, 3 times a week, and provide dialysis. And I remember one day he said to me, called me up. He said, Ryan, I'm all done. We don't need you anymore. I go, well, you know, I forget the guy's name off. Joe, you know, that's going to be bad. You sure about this? Like, you're gonna die. And he's like, yep, I talked to my family. I don't need you anymore. Thank you very much. But, you know, life sucks and I don't like it and I'm not doing this anymore. And my quality of life is bad and I'm ready. You know, like, let's, you know, and my mom was very similar to that when she got her diagnosis and we found out it was stage 4. You know, if you find out you have stage 4 cancer, you know that your chances of you know, hitting that 5-year survival mark are very, very low, unfortunately. And, you know, there got to be a point where she had that acceptance where like, hey, listen, you know, let's worry about quality of life over quantity of life, because we're talking about days, and if I'm lucky, maybe a month or two. So, you know, what are we arguing over for a couple weeks or a couple months of life when I'm in pain and I'm not happy and this stinks and my son and my husband are going through all this pain and suffering too, and you know, all of that is taken into consideration. And you know, that would be detrimental for my business without a doubt, right? If that was the situation, if people had more honest conversations and people were able to go the way they want to go. But I think it's the right thing to do in the end of things and the whole scope, because eventually I'm going to be there and I'm going to be saying, hey, I wish I really fought hard for this, because eventually, more than likely, unless I get hit by the bus, the proverbial bus, you're likely going to be in that scenario where your wishes are hopefully granted, but maybe not.
I'll just add one point to that. I actually think if we have these honest conversations about how we define quality of life, and what happens if that quality of life no longer exists for us, we actually have some certainty, and it allows us to budget more effectively. We can say, you know what, let's spend some money now, because we know that we're getting towards that point where we're just not going to do anything aggressive. I think it gives us permission to spend money more wisely, because right now we're in a situation where we think we've got to just save the money because we've got to save it forever. And if we have an idea that the end has a time and that it's going to arrive, it gives us permission to spend money in a more wise way. We Absolutely. Don't hold it for the rainy day.
Yeah, because the rainy day may not come. I mean, it's the same.
I think it's raining already. Yeah. It's raining already, so spend the money. Don't wait for the thunderstorm and tornado. Spend the money now.
Absolutely. Well, the old saying, live like every day is your last, right? Maybe that's not, don't take that to the extreme, but the point being is like, you know, don't have the regrets of not saying the things or doing the things you've always wanted to do. And sometimes we need a reminder of that, right? But excellent. Anyways, thank you so much for your time. It's been a good hour, and I think it was worthwhile in learning about your new endeavor and certainly getting your opinions on things. Now, summarizing, wrapping this up, please take a few minutes, talk about your business again, and then that way people will be able to reach out to you, whether that's email, whether that's Twitter, whether that's your website, whatever you'd like to talk about.
Yeah, basically what I do is empower and transform. So I empower individuals during their caregiving experience, and then I help them transform that experience into something bigger and better for them after caregiving ends. We do have regular events that you are welcome to attend. They are virtual. We also always put out calls for presenters. So we do have a couple events that are coming up in August and October. And if you're interested in learning about presenting at these events, you can go to my website. And again, that's careyearsacademy.com. Our August event is for former family caregivers. It's called Beginning Again, and it's a virtual retreat. And then in October, we're going to try to solve some problems, and we're going to share what our big ideas are. So if you have a big idea that you think could change the landscape, consider being a presenter. And again, you can go to careyearsacademy.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on this. It's, you know, I talk a lot of the podcasts, I end up just yabbering on about, you know, news articles I see, and hopefully people like that. But I always think it's best to bring in outside people to give a different perspective on things, and it keeps it fresh. And of course, it lets the audience know about what you're doing and the great work that you're trying to do and you are doing for people. So thank you for coming on.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much. This was great.
And thank you all for listening to the Caregiver's Toolbox. We greatly appreciate you listening. I wish you health. I wish you safety. And I will catch you on the next one. Have a great day.